You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
That's tricky because we have been, I'd say me, Chris, and Barnaby have been a little harsh on new breweries that claim to be metal. There, I have to say that it has become the thing to do, you know? So I guess it has to be true. It has to, you can't just make a beer that's metal. It has to be throughout your whole culture. You don't just go to a metal show once a year kind of thing.
You know, you're born into it, really.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hops heads? I'm Matt, the vocalist of Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, brought to you by Sound Talent Media, where I sit down with fellow metal musicians to talk about their lives, music, and craft beer. I hope that you've had a great week so far. I most certainly have been. Before we jump into today's episode, I would just like to ask you to follow the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast on the podcast platform of your choice. But more than that, I'm also asking you to rate it and write a review. Why do you ask? Because when you write a review, you could be the person that sways someone to become a future Vox and Hops head. When someone's looking for a new podcast to invest their time into, what do? They scroll down, they read the reviews. If those reviews reflect something that they are interested in, something that touches upon their core values, they are most likely going to give that podcast a chance. So please take the time to rate and write a review for the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, because that would be something that I would truly, truly appreciate. Now, on today's episode, I am with metal and beer legends Todd Haug and Chris Bogus of Three Floyds Brewing. This is Vox and Hops episode number 265.
I warn you, what you are about to hear is very disturbing indeed.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today, I'm with Chris Bogus and Todd Haug of Three Floyds Brewing. I have been waiting a long time to say those words. Vox and Hops has been around for over 2 years now. It is crazy that it's taken me this long to sit down with the original metal and beer people. So how are you guys doing today?
Doing good.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Very, very stoked to be with you both. I like to start these things off recently with a shitty question so we can go to better places afterwards. How did you guys cope with the glorious year that is now behind us of 2020?
Go ahead, Chris.
It was horrible. It was, it's almost impossible to run a factory in this kind of condition. And it's, the nightmares aren't ending yet, so it's still kind of 2020 plus right now.
Mm-hmm. It's the bonus time right now. We're in the bonus time.
Yeah. Right.
Have lots of speedballs.
Yes.
Having spoken to a bunch of brewers and, you know, breweries, I know that a lot of them really suffered because they normally pump a bunch of brews into kegs and those go into bars. Is that something that you guys got hit with?
Yeah, pretty hard. When the shutdown happened on the 15th of March last year, I mean, our production cratered pretty hard, and then everything went into package, and we were able to catch up. But it took, I think, until like July. Todd, does that sound right? Or July, August?
Yeah.
To kind of get our volumes back. Just freaking out the whole time. Still freaking out.
Hmm. Is that how you guys are capable to expand into different areas now because you have all this extra beer that needs to go somewhere?
That was actually planned.
Yeah, Todd built our new brew house, and that went on. You did well. Oversaw it anyway. And was in the summer of 19.
Mm. Yeah.
And we didn't have our new markets open yet, so it was kind of slow going at the beginning. And then we We're starting to pump out a lot of beer there right now.
Yeah, as luck would have it, we had just kind of put together a sales team and management to launch some new markets before the pandemic, and that was already kind of set up. So we just delayed it later until last year, and then the sales guys are like, "Well, we could still do this. We have this new brewery." Luckily, we were able to shift all of our production after we figured out that kegs were gone, sales were gone there, into bottles and cans. And that's, I mean, we were lucky to be at that position in our growth to be able to do that. A lot of breweries couldn't. We have friends that sold all their beer draft only, and they had to scramble to figure packaging out. So we just kind of sidestepped. I hate to say it and laugh, but we couldn't have planned it better, actually, because we were able to just kind of dodge it a little bit. And you know, obviously the pub suffered, that whole culture of the pub and Dark Lord, they suffered, but from a production standpoint, we were able to just shift and move everything into a different package and roll it out into different markets. So we had increased production because of the new facility, to answer your question. So it wasn't just because of the draft volume that had dropped. It was already planned. And there's an increase in production coming anyway. So
good. Well, that's an excellent, excellent timing.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, we signed with our East Coast distributor in early March of 20. So like we were in New York City signing papers and the pandemic hit like a week later. So we were kind of set the wheels in motion at that point.
Very, very fortuitous that it happened that way versus the opposite a few weeks later. Vox and Hops is all about hanging out with my metal friends and talking about their lives, music, and craft beer. What are we drinking today on each of our sides? Let's present what we got going on.
I'm having, I don't know if you call it craft beer anymore, Devil's Backbone, but I got one of their lagers on a little road trip, and it's killer.
Awesome. How about you, Todd?
Since it's morning for me, I'm drinking a can of coffee from Dark Matter. They're Vanilla Suburbs. It's like 600 milligrams of caffeine, so...
You'll be awake by the end of this.
I doubt it.
On my side, I have Montreal's Dark Lord. I call them that. They're nothing close to the Dark Lords, what you guys pull off, but I call them that because they only brew dark beers, and I think that's super cool. This is Brasserie Borregaux. It's their Imperial Macadam. It is a vanilla macadamia nut imperial stout aged in bourbon barrels. Something that will insult your laws of purity.
Beer. No, I mean, we're prostitutes, too.
That's fancy, dude.
They're killer. They're doing really cool stuff here. They seriously only do black beers, and they actually put out a double dry hopped IPA last summer that just fucked up everyone's mind because it wasn't a black IPA. It was just a black New England, which is very cool. I'm going to crack this. You guys crack whatever you guys got going on, and we'll do a little cheers, and we'll keep going.
That is pretty tough, all black beers.
Yeah, as a brewer, that sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, challenging.
Awesome. Cheers. Stoked to be
here. Cheers, guys. Cheers.
Good, man.
Bourbon kick on the nose. And super sweet, nutty, killer. Nice pastry stout. Love it. Love it. Pastry stout at 2 p.m. It's going to be a good Saturday.
It's only downhill from here.
That's right.
Let's talk about beer. Let's talk about your very first beers. Do you remember the first beers that you guys had?
Clearly. Yeah, clearly. Well, my first beer I ever had, a buddy of mine, we were on our bikes, we were 13. Somehow we managed to get a 12-pack of PBR.
Yes.
That was the first time I was drunk on beer. But my first taste of beer, I was in Germany, actually, playing soccer. And the host family laughed and served me pizza, which is horrible, and this little mini keg of beer. And that was the same year, but I thought it was horrible. I didn't know what beer, I didn't know what it was supposed to taste like, I didn't like it. But then when I got home, I was all about, and I had to drink beer. So then from there on, I, from PBR, drank crappy macro beers until I was 17, and then the guys in the band turned me on to good, better beers, everything from Pete's Wicked Ale and Sierra Nevada and Celebration Ale and Anchor Liberty Ale, everything that was available in the late 80s. I tried, so that was the end. It was the start right there. So
that's the slippery slope right there.
Yeah.
How about you, Chris?
Mine had to be either a Coors Banquet or a Stroh's for my uncle. It was one or the other because they were really into the Coors Banquet. This was right around, you know, I was like 8 or 9. So that's when Smokey and the Bandit came out, and that was a big deal. So I tasted it, you know, and I thought it was gross. Mm-hmm. And then definitely in high school, it was Milwaukee's Best. I mean, all day. And then into college too. And then the gateway beers for me, you know, being Oklahoma and Texas were were Newcastle and Guinness. And then that was kind of the beginning. Mm. Then when I had a Liberty, Anchor Liberty, it kind of blew my mind, you know, in the mid early 90s.
I remember drinking a lot of that stout from Australia, Sheaf Stout. Remember that? It was in a cool bottle. That was a treat. Like, that was, just, you know, something we could get regularly, but was exotic and, like, a big stout, compared to Guinness, at least.
Moosehead was an exotic beer for me in Oklahoma.
Well, in Minnesota, Coors was exotic because we couldn't get it. There's a guy down the street where I grew up that somehow bootlegged it, and I would see as a kid, I would bike by his house and see a pallet of Coors in his garage. I don't know how he got it, but...
A pallet?
Yeah.
Oh, my yep. God.
Yeah.
He had good friends.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let's talk about brewer stories. How did you guys end up brewing beer, living for the world of beer?
I got an art degree at a football college, so I was...
really?
Yeah, super awesome degree.
You can just stop right there, Chris.
Yeah. So, I was a waiter when I got out of school, and I managed to start waiting tables at a brew pub called Rock Bottom in Houston, Texas. And I want to say six months to a year after I started working there, I was able to sneak into the brew house because it looked awesome. And I like the beers, you know, it's the first real fresh beer I've ever had. And 6 months later, the guy that taught me left, and he went to open another Rock Bottom, and I barely knew what to do. Still barely know what to do, but, 6 months of training, I was able to repeat what he told me, and that was the end of that. That was like 1995.
How about you, Todd?
Let's see. I got into beer because the guys in the band, and I got home from tour and decided I needed to know how to brew, so I started home brewing. My brother was selling, working for a local company in the Twin Cities, Minnesota, a company that sold like outerwear for like active, you know, skiing and stuff. So he had a store in Wisconsin that sold stuff for sports outside, and also it was a homebrew store. At the time, there was not a homebrew store, so I had that catalog through my brother, and I saw their homebrewing kit, so I ordered it, and I surprised Jeff, our bass player, because he had no idea he'd be into it. But I started homebrewing, and then later that year, I did a course at Summit Brewing in St. Paul. It was a beer styles course led by Mark Stutter, the president, founding guy. And I asked him, hey, do you guys ever need help? And he said, yeah, we do. There's a list. About 3 months later, I called and spoke with the guy on the phone. I said, hey, I did this thing with Mark, and he told me to call, put my name on the list. And I thought it'd be like months of waiting. And then I got a call the next week to come in to help package and bottle. So I show up. It was me and a guy from a temp agency across the packing table from me, hand packing bottles into six packs. And from that day on, I worked at Summit for almost 5 years after that. Was brewing a year later. And I kind of found a place that John, the guy that answered the phone and called me back, was ended up being my mentor and sent me on a path that I kind of followed with all the building stuff and repairing stuff that's not not technically brewing, but it has to happen for brewing to be successful. So that kind of set me on my course of liking to take things apart and fix them and make them run and brewing at the same time. So
that's amazing. Every band needs a guy like that can take apart an amp and put it back together, because it's going to break. It's going to happen on tour, and it's the same thing in a brewery. Every brewery needs that guy that can just jump in there and fix it.
Right. Or at least make it so you can safely get through the brew, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 100%. Or finish that show.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Let's talk about metal. Tell me about your early life as metalheads. How did you end up being a metalhead?
I I wasn't a metalhead. I actually was into, I started playing guitar when I was seven and followed my brother's and sister's musical interests. So I was into classic rock, early Van Halen, stuff like that. And then when I got to be in my teens, I fell in love with fusion, Al Di Meola and Pat Metheny and everything. John Lucpani and then Alan Holdsworth and all that stuff that was not metal and was about music theory and everything else. So I was a snob a little bit, and when I first actually still kicked myself in eighth grade, I turned down an opportunity to see Metallica. So that would have been in 1984, and I said no. And and then it wasn't until I got into high school that a friend of mine said, hey, this band, local band, is looking for a guitar player. I think your technique and style would fit. And he gave me this cassette, and it was Power Mad, and I listened to it, and I made a demo, and I kind of it struck a chord in me, if you will. Like, I was like, the music was important. I felt it, you know? And at that point, I had a newfound respect for, I was a junior in high school, so I loved, all of a sudden, Metallica made sense, and I couldn't believe how amazing it was. And but I still love fusion. I still love them both. So from that point on, I started my metal love as a listener probably late compared to most people. So as a result, I'm still way into it. If probably more now than I used to be, which I think is awesome. A lot of people have kind of drifted away from it, which is lame.
I think I might have gotten into it after you, Todd. Then
really?
Because I was classic rock Led Zeppelin to the bone until I graduated high school. And then when I got in college, someone played Cause of Death, and that changed my life. But that was like, I don't know when that come out, 89 or 90.
But
I heard it for the first time in like 91. I was like, okay, now I like metal. And then I listened to Black Sabbath, and then I listened to Slayer, but it was Cause of Death that kind of started everything for me.
It's a killer record. Let's talk about your first shows. Do you remember the first shows that you guys went to go see?
Luckily, my parents, my dad and my mom had a business that they could like actively barter, it was called in the 80s, it wasn't a trade. But so I got to go to a bunch of shows at the Carlton Celebrity Room, which is in the movie Fargo.
Really?
So I got to see a bunch of crazy stuff, everything from Bob Hope, with Bob Bacharach and Carol Bayer Sager and all these, like the Oak Ridge Boys, like crazy stuff that a 10-year-old would never think he should go to. So I was exposed to live music almost weekly through my parents. So then I started playing shows when I was 12. And then I have all ever since the pandemic started. But then my first arena concert was Jethro Tull.
Nice.
And I went with a buddy's older sister. And then my first kind of hard rock concert was Van Halen, 1984.
Wow.
That was amazing.
I can imagine
sweet.
That. Super hype, excitement.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. But they opened with Unchained, and I lost my shit. I just, like, completely freaked out.
Was Diamond Dave jumping, doing
oh, yeah.
lights?
Oh, yeah.
Right when the lights went on?
Yeah.
Cool.
Oh, he was so killer back then.
Yeah.
How about you, Chris?
My first concert was Kool & the Gang.
Whoa.
It was Roger opened for Kool & the Gang. It was pretty badass. And that was at an arena. And I think, I must have been 12. But, I don't know why my parents let me go. It was just me and my buddy. We were just 12-year-old kids at Kool & the Gang.
Different era.
I hope you dressed up.
I probably had a Terry Cloth shirt on. I don't know.
Yeah. Boots, fuzzy boots.
Yeah. And then my first metal show, man, I can't remember. In college, I saw a band called Carnage. That was a death metal band from Florida. They weren't that good, but it was fun. Wait, no, the band was called Homicide. They were really good. And the first metal, I was kind of into like Butthole Surface and stuff. So I didn't really go to metal shows until after school, like that I had to move to Texas. And I saw, I'd see Dio and Motorhead and all the time. That's when I met Barnaby, Todd, and he would take me to all those shows.
Cool.
Yeah.
I remember seeing... Go ahead.
Oh, and then when I moved to... I'm sorry, I'm just kind of giving you more than you asked for, Matt.
No worries.
I bounced around with Rock Bottom and moved to Long Beach, California, and that's when I started seeing tons of shows. I'd see High on Fire 4 times a year, you know, for 8 years in a row. It was incredible. You know, and if you're in the Los Angeles area, there's always a show. So that's where I kind of got in my time.
That's amazing. It's like that in Montreal. We're very lucky here in Montreal to just be, you know, any night of the week before the pandemic, there was multiple shows going on most of the time. Okay. It's amazing. What is the last show that you saw before the pandemic shut us down?
Boy.
Shit.
I don't know. We just got done playing some shows with I play bass and a fellow brewer friend of ours, Eric Ogashok's band, Candy of the Skull, and we're doing shows right up to it. Then a bunch got canceled as it happened. So I don't know what I'd seen. I mean, so at those shows that I was at, but there's some festival in Chicago, and then some shows we did in St. Paul and Milwaukee. What was the last show we went to?
Yeah, I can't remember.
I don't know if I can either. I know that the sleep show on New Year's Eve was that New Year's Eve, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because last year, weed was made legal in Illinois, so sleep played on New Year's Eve as the clock turned. It was pretty amazing.
That sounds like a genius idea, whoever set that up.
It's a pretty amazing smoke out.
Whoever set that up.
I think I missed that show.
Yeah, I don't know where you were.
Yeah, I was out of town or something.
That's a killer idea.
It might have been like, it could have been like a Decibel Fest. That's my last show, which is sad.
Which is a perfect transition because I'm going towards metal and beer. How did you guys figure out that metal and beer go so well together? You know, Three Floyds is Surly and Three Floyds are basically the OGs of this. So at what point did you realize that this is a match made in heaven?
Oh, it's just kind of natural for us. I mean, that's what we like. And I'll talk about Barnaby again. He was really good at connecting those dots with musicians. Like, he was just kind of a shameless dude, and he would just be, hey, let's hang out. Let's make a beer. So that was kind of – he started that all for us. You know, back when we did that first beer with Pelican, I want to say 10 years ago or more.
Yeah.
Wow. That was the first band collab?
Yeah, for us.
But also, we were living it. I mean, we were living it. We were, you know, we worked for a company, me, Barnaby, and Chris, worked for a company, Rock Bottom. We were up brewers that ran our own breweries. And we saw each other maybe once or twice a year. But when we did, we were the metal guys, and we were just like, you know, get attracted to each other because of that, but also because there's a repelling force. Because all the other brewers were hippies, and the company was based in Colorado. So it became us versus them. Not that they're still our friends, but as far as who we were and who we identified with musically and the attitude that we felt carried it over into our beer, because we were into metal and we wanted our beers to be metal, but we were trapped in this company that would never allow that, you know, would never allow the beers to be perceived as metal and marketed that way. So that just kind of festered and grew. And as we all moved on from Rock Bottom, we carried that torch as high and as hard as we could, and kind of developed into what it is today.
Yeah. But, you know, it's Rock Bottom's fault because they would make us listen to Rusted Root. And it was hell. Yeah, Hootie and the Blowfish. It was just they drove us to do it.
Yeah, and you'd step in the brew house, and I would have just like brutal shit on, like 3 feet away through glass to a customer's eating during lunch into the brew house, and I'm just listening to whatever as loud as I can. Same with Chris. And they're like smiling, and I'm in there smiling. Even they know that we were driven and motivated to make it through those days. You know, being in a fish aquarium like a you know, an attraction at a brew pub, people to watch work. We were listening to metal, and it kept us sane.
I love that. I've had Chris Dodge on the podcast. I've had Albert from Decibel. I've had the original Adam on the podcast, and I asked him all this question: what makes a metal brewery? Because now that you guys are the OGs, but there's a lot more of them now. So what defines a metal brewery?
That's tricky, because we have been, I'd say me, Chris, and Barnaby have been a little harsh on new breweries that claim to be metal.
But posers.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that it has become the thing to do, you know? So I guess it has to be true. It has to, you can't just make a beer that's metal. It has to be throughout your whole culture, I think. You don't just go to a metal show once a year kind of thing.
You know? More organic, kind of, you know, you're born into it, really.
I love it. So it's not like that guy that we all know, this person that claims to be a metalhead that has that one metal shirt that he pulls on and then goes to his show and then goes through the rest of his life with his business casual.
Yeah. Is it a Manowar shirt? Is it a Manowar shirt?
Manowar shirts are the best.
They are the best.
So, you know, there are a lot of metal breweries or people deeming themselves as a metal brewery. How do you guys feel about that? You mentioned poser, you said.
I'm just being a jackass.
But is it something that, you know, you were the first for so long and you guys were that brewery. What about when you saw all these other ones popping up? Was that something like, oh, cool, our culture is growing? Or was it more of like a who do they think they are type syndrome or reaction?
I thought it was cool, for sure. I think it's cool.
Yeah, I would say it was, at first it was, who are these? Well, that's how a lot of us brewers, we went from, you know, under 2,000 breweries in this country to almost 10,000 breweries. So most of us that have been doing this for 20, 30 years for a living are like, who are all these assholes opening new breweries? So it's the same thing with, like, who are all these guys that are in the metal now? But I've softened. I think we have to, I'm softened up. It's like, the more the merrier. And I'm not going to judge them, because we need metal to survive, and it's with everything changing the way it is, as far as how music is released and how people even learn about new music and bands, we need all the help we can get. So
true.
So I'm less harsh. I used to be pretty, me and Barnaby especially would be pretty brutal, but it's also because it made us laugh. So
yeah. It's fun to be dicks.
Yeah.
We all have to work together. We're all fighting the same big monsters, whether it be, you know, commercial rock music or pop music, the metal industry. We're trying to, you know, hash out our space and find new listeners every day, get a new generation into the old classic metal so that they can keep this genre alive. I feel like metal is on fire. It's more popular than ever. Same thing with craft beer. So they go so well together, which is why Vox and Hops works. So I definitely encourage everyone just to work together and to collaborate and to keep spreading the good word of metal and craft beer, which is where collabs come in just so perfectly. So you mentioned Barnaby encouraged the first one for Pelican. I have had a few of the Three Floyds collabs. They were super sick. I was on tour with Cannibal Corpse and Obituary, and Obituary got their Hopped in Half delivered onto our bus by one of you, actually.
Yeah, it might have been me.
It was delicious.
Those guys were super cool. As you know, you work with them. But, you know, they like Budweiser. I mean, they weren't trying to hide what they were into. So I tried to make something that was good and that they would like. So I'm not sure how much they liked it, but they were appreciative and cool about it.
They were very cool whenever, you know, that all the beers went into this communal ice thing on the bus, and Cryptopsy being Cryptopsy, we like to drink beer. So we would dig into this ice thing, and every once in a while, our hand would fall onto one of the Hopped in Halves, and we'd pull it up and we'd look over at the Tardy Boys and be like, is this cool? And they were always like, it's cool, you can have it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
We also really enjoyed the, I got to taste one of the Amber Smash faces there. But let's talk about your mentality towards doing collabs for bands. Is that, talk me through how you think about that. How does these relationships form? Is it complicated? I'm sure you guys get hit up by way more bands than you actually do. So how do you guys decide who to make a collab for?
So we've got, Dave Witte is kind of our Johnny Appleseed of spreading the word. Big fans of him and the band, of course, but as an individual, he's like one of the best dudes. And when we get in to some like Cannibal Corpse or Obituary, for instance, I don't know if he helped me kind of close the dots, but I think he did. Like, he was able to get me in contact with those guys. And that was a lot of fun to make beer with those two legendary bands. So it's more like, guys, I want to make beer with just because I love the music. I'm not looking to do a ton of them because it does take some effort, and I don't want to fuck it up. So we've been a little bit more selective lately and I'm not trying to push the issue with any certain bands, but I don't know if I answered your question, but
You did. You definitely did. So I was just more curious, like, how often do you guys get hit up? I imagine there's bands that are hitting you up all the time.
A lot.
So how do you go about a selection process?
Well, it's gotten easier because in the last couple of years, I've gotten some pretty amazing ones. I don't even know if I've told Chris about them all because, to be honest, I know they're not, wouldn't happen. So now my reply is to just tell them I'm of our limited distribution area, mm-hmm. and they immediately never come back. that's how you shut down Motley Crue. That's how you shut down Motorhead. Anyone that's suddenly, you hear from their manager and they want to make a beer, it's clearly marketing.
Yeah,
which
yeah, yeah.
is the number one thing that I wouldn't touch. It has to be, I mean, Chris said that. It's usually, I have to be a fan. Like, I have to go to their show and be there and maybe meet them before I get a chance to pitch it, So for years, me, Barnaby, and Chris would work it. I'd go to a show and the guys I got to know in Skeleton Witch, I would be like, hey, you guys, have you talked to Barnaby yet? So I would hammer him in Minnesota. And Scott would be like, no, I forgot. I got to get a hold of him. And then I'd, again, make sure that he had Barnaby's contact info and back and forth. So we would kind of triangulate a little bit. In Minnesota, I didn't have the opportunity to do a lot of collabs, official collabs that got packaged. But we were doing a lot of show-only, draft-only beers, which I thought was pretty cool because it was hyper small. And it worked out. The band got a bigger draw at the show. It was a cross promotion kind of thing, but also it kind of kept the hyper small crafty kind of component to it. Because once you got a package of beers, it gets more difficult. You got to somehow get the story all the way through to through the liquor store. And a lot of customers don't get the band collab beers. They don't understand it. They just, except for Three Floyds, because it doesn't look different than their normal beers. So it works for Three Floyds. But most other breweries, it looks like an oddball that they just, like a cast out beer that doesn't make any sense.
That metal shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
The Man of War shirt in the business casual drawer.
Right. Where it works at Three Floyds. So
yeah. Oily abs works really well.
Mm-hmm. I love it. So you guys, mostly it's you guys approaching bands versus the opposite way. See, I didn't know that. I think that's super cool.
It's kind of a 50-50.
Yeah, but usually we know them.
Yeah. Like with Cannibal and Obituary, it was just definitely me going after those guys because I love them.
Right.
Yeah.
And the amount of times people say Dave Woody's name on this podcast is...
Who?
Dave, yeah. Witte.
Uncle Dave.
He's the best. Let's talk about hype. I think you guys have the most hype ever when it comes to Dark Lord Day. How did you figure out that doing something limited, something cool, and obviously it ties to metal because, when there's those limited runs of either merch drops or vinyls or, it sells out, is gone, and Dark Lord is always gone. So I've never had one, to be honest. So how did you figure out that this would work?
The music day, or, you know, that was Nick for sure. He was
that's all Nick.
Super into making beer that was just ridiculous. Maybe the first to do it, really. And it just kind of became this thing that he released it once a year, and it grew to be this big event. And then at some point we were like, well, why don't we just make it a music festival too?
Amazing.
And we'd just party our ass off, sell a bunch of beer, drink a bunch of beer. And it just kind of went from there. But yeah, it was kind of like the early 2000s, when like the rate beer in that thing kind of really helped Three Floyds. And, you know, Nick was making these big, gigantic beers, and people would, you know, we're Chicago area too, so there's lots of people that were able to come by and drink the beer, or, you know, get on online and you know, tell people that they liked it and thought it was good, that kind of stuff.
Very cool. Very, very cool. That's smart. You gotta play with the tools at hand to
exactly.
Push yourself forward as always. Let's wrap this up. Classic Vox and Hops wrap-up question. Probably never happens to you guys because you guys have been in the industry for a long time, but every once in a while it happens to everyone. What are your hangover cures?
Oh, geez. So I think my favorite one is probably the Michelada. You just go straight to the, you know, the Mexican red beer. I love that. And then I'm usually good to go after a couple of those. How about you?
For myself, I suffer in silence, and because I got two young kids, so they didn't drink the beers, right? So, and another bastardization of beer, a fruited sour, will always put me back on my feet. We got a really good brewery here in Montreal called Pub Brewski. They make these things called brew juices, and you drink a brew juice and you're right back on track. It's a fruited kettle sour with a fruit puree in it. So
I like that. I like that name.
Yes.
What is it? Brew juice?
Brew juice. And I'm not sure that this happens. By the time this episode comes out, my collab with them, Brutal Juice, will be out.
Nice. Awesome.
How about you, Todd? What's your hangover cure?
Anything carbonated, like you know, sparkling wine or mimosa, and then your Bloody Mary, and some something to eat. Usually sets me up for a nap, and then I get up and ready to go.
Excellent. Classics. Chris, Todd, thank you so much for taking the time talking to me about life, metal, and craft beer. I truly, truly appreciate it. I can't wait till this pandemic is over and I can be back out on tour and come and visit you guys in the flesh and hang out for real.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hey, thank you all so much for listening right to the end. You know that I love and appreciate that. Man, I had a great time hanging out with Chris and Todd, living beer and metal legends. I had such a blast finally connecting with the original beer and metal people. They make killer beer, metal as fuck. I absolutely love them. Next time I'm anywhere near them, I am coming out to hang out. Todd, Chris, get ready. We're going to have a good, good time. If you enjoyed this Vox and Hops episode, you should absolutely sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing list. You could do that on my website, voxandhops.com. That's voxandhops.com. And when you do that, you shall receive one email a week containing all of the details of everything that has happened throughout the past week in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, including all the details for any episodes which I have dropped throughout that past week, if I've been a guest on someone else's podcast, all of the information for any cool projects that I have coming up, the links to the upcoming live interview Thirsty Thursday virtual hangs, as well as the links to the Brutal Awakening playlist, which is available on both Apple Music and Spotify and is curated by my man Jerry Monk, the metal architect himself. Do yourself a favor, everyone, sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing us, because there's a whole bunch of stuff going on and I would hate for you to miss something. The Vox and Hops Metal Podcast is brought to you by Sound Talent Media. I hope that you have a glorious weekend. I will be back next week with two episodes, but until then, remember to enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. Cheers, Vox and Hops heads.
welcome to us talking about our podcast for a minute.
What's the name of that podcast?
That's Axe to Grind. And right now you're going to be getting a little taste of it, right down to the shaky microphone and all.
And my name's Bob.
And my name's Patrick. And usually we're joined by Tom.
Tom's the best. Tom has a real grown-up job that requires him to be at work. But we talk about decidedly not so grown-up things like
hardcore music and things that people that like hardcore music tend to like.
So that could be the latest shows, revisiting classic material, talking about the new classics, all the little dorm room nonsense that you imagine from a niche music podcast that you either love, want to love, or hate.
Yeah, imagine all the emotions that you have towards a genre that has impacted your life, and then condense them down to an hour to 2 hours a week.
So triangulate your speakers. Think about jumping off the bed, singing along, dancing like an idiot, and listen to Axe to Grind podcast.